You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
The tariffs are about the supply of goods. Immigration is about the supply of labor. And it's exactly what you said, Mona. You're driving inflation on the side of labor, which, as Hassett and Bess and others will tell you, like the labor stuff is driving a lot of the cost increases now.
Great. I'm so glad we have geniuses in charge. Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could be here today. I am delighted to welcome my friend and colleague, Will Salatin of The Bulwark. For those of you who are not Bulwark Plus members, you will perhaps not know that Will and I have a long history together where we were recording once every 3 weeks or so, a different podcast that was for members only. The reason I wanted to have Will on this podcast is because Will has a kind of reputation around the shop for being the guy who can always find the optimistic take on the news. He's the one who finds the little pony in the, you know, the old story about, you know, the shoveling the you know what and finding the pony underneath. He was always going to be the one to find the pony, even to the point of he's not at home right now, but at home he has a little like pony doll that he keeps on his shelf and he brings out just for, you know, giving us the optimistic take. Well, Will, first of all, thank you for being here. It is holiday time. And the reason I wanted you here is there are actually a lot of ponies at the moment. Like earlier this year, we had to really struggle to come up with something. But I would love to sit with you now and go through all of the things that are going so badly wrong for this authoritarian nightmare, boor, hideous creature who is the president of the United States.
Let's do it.
You good with this plan?
I haven't heard a better plan in months, Mona. So I am so excited. You've brought the ponies today. I'm already warmed up. This is
all right.
Joyous. Okay.
Okay. So I think from my perspective, it goes back, the good news started to come in at the time of the No Kings rallies around the country, the second set. That, I guess, was in October, if I remember correctly. And I participated. Did you participate?
No. No, I did not. I had to like pause there for a minute and then just fess up. I did not. I did not. I did observe on our Slack channel all of the good people here who did participate. I was not among them. Forgive me.
Well, you missed out because it was really fun. And it was so encouraging and just soul enriching to be surrounded by so many people who were, first of all, you remember the dire predictions from Trump and from Mike Johnson that there was, first of all, this was going to be a huge Antifa thing, right? And it was going to be violent.
And Hamas, it was going to be a Hamas thing. Hamas, Hamas everywhere. Thing.
Okay, there we go. And of course, millions of people, even in reddest red states, showed up, were very peaceful, and were funny as hell. I mean, the signs, I was at the big one in D.C. I mean, there were a number of big ones, but that may have been the mother of them all, the one in D.C. Mm-hmm. And I don't even like crowds. I really don't. I really go a long way to avoid a crowd. I don't go to the fireworks on the mall on the 4th of July. I don't like being surrounded by that many people. But I made an exception in this case. And I have to tell you, it was so encouraging and seeing all these funny, witty signs and the funny costumes. You know, people had just the right combination of wit, defiance, good humor, and passion, real passion for, you know, what this country should be about and the whole idea of no kings. All right. So that was the first thing. Then there were the elections, right?
Yeah.
Did you predict, Will, that the elections would go as well as they did?
No, I don't. I mean, I thought the Democrats would win them. The margins were bigger than I expected.
Yeah.
To be fair, they were bigger than the polls expected.
Absolutely.
So, you know, not so much in Virginia. The New Jersey result was significantly wider than people thought. And so I'm going to plead like every other pundit, I paid attention to the polls. And in this case, I was pleasantly surprised.
So not only did the voters deliver a stinging rebuke to Trump, including in places like Georgia, where two public service commissioners were up for election. They got overwhelmed. Democrats got overwhelmingly elected in Georgia. But it was also the case that, and it's worth remembering that when this whole gerrymandering thing got rolling, this latest iteration, when Trump told Texas and other red states to gerrymander, and Texas, you know, immediately did it, right? And then there were a lot of think pieces about how, you know, Republicans really have a structural advantage here. I mean, it's going to be really tough for the Democrats, even if the Democrats decide to play hardball here. And I remember you and I even discussed this. Should they play hardball? Should they not? Gerrymandering is terrible. We all agree, really bad. But the question was, you know, can Democrats even do it? Because there are more red states than there are blue states, and more opportunities, perhaps for the Republicans to gain seats in this illegitimate fashion than for the Democrats to do so. And would the Democrats even do so? Their best pickup opportunity would have been California, where they had just carefully, painfully passed a good government policy of doing electoral districts only by a commission and not gerrymandering, which was a hard fought battle for legal reform. And yet the voters overwhelmingly said, okay, Texas, if this is how you're going to play it, two can play this game. And so it passed by a lot in California. And even though you and I both dislike gerrymandering and think it's terrible, I thought that was a victory too for the anti-authoritarians. What did you think?
Well, I that's a really interesting statement, Mona. This is, so I should back up for a minute. It's very amusing to me that sort of I came into the bulwark as at that time, the House Lib, And so here are all these former Republicans, people who, worked in Republican White Houses back in the day. And they're the ones who are out at the protest. Like, I went to Swarthmore College, like the idea that I wasn't at the protest and Mona Charon was, is just, that's just chef's kiss. That's that. So,
because as former Republicans, we know the danger.
Right. But to come back to the California thing, it is interesting to me that you foreign policy conservatives probably understand this as well as anybody. We don't like to have nuclear weapons. We don't want to have an arms race. But there are bad people in the world, and they're building up their weapons. And the only way that we're ever going to have enough leverage to negotiate something saner than a runaway arms race is to be able to threaten them. That is what Gavin Newsom did in California.
Exactly.
You can construct an arms control rationale for that. And look, we are probably two of the most procedure fixated people here in terms of like, look, we really shouldn't be abandoning norms, abandoning rules, even abandoning traditions. I don't know where you are on the filibuster, but I constantly get grief here. I'm like the only pro filibuster person in the office. So
I think Sarah is.
I like these institutions and traditions and whatnot. And then I feel icky every time somebody says, well, let's just redistrict the last 7 Republicans out of their seats in California, or I'm in Maryland. And the situation here is there's 1 Republican in a delegation, and Westmore and the Democrats are like, let's get rid of that seat. And that's just like, it's crazy to me that a state that is like at least a third Republican,
like
they're going to get rid of the last Republican seat. And that all of that feels wrong to me. But then I think about how disgustingly cynical it is that in the middle of the decade, the Republicans are like, the only way we can maintain power is to re-engineer the seats. And it is a fundamentally, I don't want to say it's undemocratic, but when the politicians are choosing their voters, that is one of the channels through which you can nominally stay democratic while you're completely undermining the spirit of democracy. And you have to fight back. You just have to against this authoritarian crowd. So I've kind of come over to the JVL, what time is it, stand up and fight. We have to break a few norms here. Position. I feel bad about it, but that's where I am, Mona. I don't know where are you?
Yeah. So I am on the gerrymandering. On certain other things, I would draw a line. But we don't have to go there right now because this is a celebratory podcast. I want to remind you this is this podcast is all about the things that are going right. This is our holiday greeting to all of our friends. Okay. So not only did California, charge in and with the significant margins say, fine, we're going to redistrict our voters and we're going to gain 5 seats. But a federal judge ruled that the Texas redistricting was actually an illegal gerrymander. And so at the moment, it looks like it could be that the Republicans who attempted this dirty trick of trying to stay in power by manipulating the districts is going to actually be hoisted by their own petard, which is just poetic justice and good. Now, it may not turn out that way in Texas, but there's one more thing to say, which became clear after the off-year elections, and that is that what the Republicans were banking on in that redistricting and in others, and in general, in terms of their power base, is they've been banking that the movement of Hispanic voters that they have seen over the last several cycles, where Hispanics have been moving more and more to the right and toward the Republican Party, was a fait accompli. It was done. That was now going to be a permanent fixture of American politics. And what we saw in the early part of this month in the election, the off-year elections is, the support for Trump and the Republicans among Hispanic voters cratered. And so that calls into question. Now, of course, Hispanic voters in New Jersey and New York and Virginia are not the same as Hispanic voters in Texas. And it's not a monolith. And, you know, who knows? But it does mean, because those five districts that the Republicans carved out in Texas that they were hoping were going to be new districts for them, were heavily Hispanic. And so
right.
could go very, very badly for them.
Yeah.
So that's,
Yeah. And a lot, if you look at the exit polls, a lot of those people moved back. And in fact, you know, I've been looking at the Mamdani vote in New York and what Mamdani has said about it. And he talks a lot about, I went after Trump voters, people who crossed over and had voted for Donald Trump. They were disillusioned with Democrats. They were unhappy about, you know, the crisis of affordability in New York City.
Cost of living, yep.
Right, cost of living. And I'm like, and, you know, it's, Mona, it's really not that complicated when you think of it. I think of the Republicans in the Trump era are a little bit like the second wife of a guy who's like, she's like, I've got this man now. He left his first wife and he's come to me and we're going to live together forever, right?
Yeah.
And maybe it should occur to you that this guy, there's all kinds of reasons why people split up, but sometimes there's certain people who are like, their attachments are not that permanent. And like these voters who a lot of, you know, Hispanic voters, Asian American voters.
That's a great analogy. I love it.
They crossed over, they voted for Trump. Yeah. But like the idea that they were permanent Republican voters, there was not much of a sample size for that, you know, and we're already starting to see some of the evidence that they're willing to move back for the same reasons they left the Democratic Party. What have you done for me lately?
Yep. By the way, that reminds me of a funny line about men and mistresses. Somebody quipped that a man who marries his mistress creates a job opening.
Oh, that's, I've never heard that. I must have lived a sheltered life not to have heard that, but that's a good line. And
okay, so another thing that has happened in the last few weeks is that we have seen juries, both grand juries and petit juries or trial juries, push back on the overreach of this Department of Justice. So this is a real sign of civic health in the country. You live in Maryland, I live in Virginia, but we're in the greater DC area. And of course, a big story, not just in our part of the world, but it did make national news also with Sandwich Man, right?
Yes.
Sandwich Man tosses, he committed, you know, assault with a breadly weapon, as people said. And that's actually something that would be worthy of a Will Salatin Slack message. Will is a great punster, really. One of the best ever. But anyway, so he threw this sandwich. And of course, this Justice Department being full of lunatics, toadies, people who have contempt for law and tradition and the way things ought to be done, led by Jeanine Pirro, who's the U.S. attorney here. The guy volunteered to turn himself in and go be arraigned, you know, for this offense. No, they sent like 20 armed guys, like, I don't know, CPB and FBI, God knows what else, you know, to his house to arrest him and bring him in.
Made him do the pepperoni walk, Mona.
I like it. And then they presented the case. They said, oh, he thinks, Jeanine Pirro even taped a little video about how tough she was going to be on this guy. And he's not laughing now. We're going to indict him for a felony, assaulting a federal officer. And she took it to like three different grand juries and they all said no. We are not indicting this guy for a felony. So finally, they get an indictment on a misdemeanor. They had to back down, right? They get an indictment on a misdemeanor. It goes to trial. The trial itself is hilarious, with the officer who was hit by the sandwich talking about being able to smell onions and mustard on his uniform, which he probably couldn't, because there was testimony, Will, that the sandwich was still fully wrapped and on the ground. There is video.
They even lie about the condiments, these people.
And of course, the jury came back not guilty. This show is sponsored by Quince. When it comes to holiday gift giving, I want to give things that people really love. Beautiful, timeless pieces they'll wear for years. That's why I'm going with Quince. From Mongolian cashmere sweaters to Italian wool coats, everything is premium quality at a price that actually makes sense. Quince has something for everyone. Soft Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50 that look and feel like designer pieces, silk tops and shirts for dressing up, perfectly cut denim for everyday wear, and outerwear that actually keeps you warm. Plus, I'm excited about their Italian wool coats. These truly are standout pieces, beautifully tailored, soft to the touch, and crafted to last for years. I really love my sweaters that I have been already wearing much more than anything else in my closet. I love cashmere, and these are beautifully soft, and it comes with, I mean, the company is very thoughtful. It not only sends you this beautiful sweater for a great price, but it sends instructions on how to care for it. Apparently, you are not supposed to dry clean your cashmere. I didn't realize that. It's better to wash it by hand and lay it out on a dryer and let it air dry, and it will last much longer. So that's the kind of care that they show for their products. Every piece is made with premium materials from ethical, trusted factories and priced far below what other luxury brands charge. The craftsmanship shows in every detail, the stitching, the fit, and the drape. It's elevated, timeless, and made to wear on repeat. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/Mona for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's Quince, quince.com/Mona to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/Mona. And there have been many other cases where grand juries have declined to indict other people, you know, who've put themselves, you know, who've been protesting, for example, as CPB and ICE are attempting to arrest people and, you know, bundle them off into unmarked vans, and people stand there protesting, and they, some of them have been charged with felonies like resisting a federal officer or assault on a federal officer, whatever. And grand juries have simply said, nope, no bill. Apparently the same thing happened in Los Angeles. So that is, not to get too highfalutin here, but honestly, this is, I talked about this with my friend of the Bulwark, Ben Wittes, founder of Lawfare. And, you know, it's a ratification of the wisdom of the founders, and actually the wisdom of Anglo-Saxon law going back many centuries, which is grand juries are performing the function they were intended to perform, which is to be a roadblock between the power of the state to hurt you and you. And so a grand jury has to see the evidence and decide whether there's a real case here. It can't just be on the say-so of the king. And, you know, grand juries are doing their jobs, which is so gratifying. Your thoughts?
It's so, Mona, this whole episode with Sandwich Guy, just let me pause on that for a minute. It's almost like we're living in a sitcom where someone has written an episode based on the old line that a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich.
I know.
It's almost like it's too perfect. Like the, it's I almost know. Like, did the guy actually throw the sandwich so he could end up in this situation where we've proved that even if they might indict a ham sandwich, they will not indict a guy for throwing a ham sandwich. Particularly a wrapped ham sandwich. It's like, I got to say, Mona, I have, and this is on the theme of the ponies, I have been really depressed ever since Trump got reelected about human nature and the nature of our country and what Americans will put up with. Like we, you know, I felt like that was a time for our national immune system to show itself, where we were just like, okay, we'll do a lot of dumb things, but we won't take a guy who attempted a coup and put him back in power. And Americans did that. And I kind of lost faith in them. But these episodes with the grand juries are a little bit restorative in terms of basic sanity. You know, to put the pony version of this might be, we have put the worst people in power. We have Donald Trump and the people around him. And it has become a filter for the worst people. The best people who worked for Donald Trump, again, within that set of people who would work for Donald Trump, the best people are all gone. They were in the first term. They got filtered out. So we now have the worst people. And that's the bad news. But the good news is what you just said. When they have any kind of filtering mechanism at all, when they have to go through just 23 ordinary people, right, who don't work for Donald Trump, you're already dealing with a set of people who are better than the current Justice Department, than Trump and his political flunkies and his appointed, you know, pseudo prosecutors. So just applying any filter at all makes things better than they were. I am surprised that the grand juries have held up as well as they have, just because I thought they would be more compliant. It might speak, Mona, to how thoroughly incompetent the Trump-appointed flunkies who brought cases to them are. I guess you could argue that in the case of Sandwich Guy, it shows that they're so indiscriminate about bringing cases. They, meaning the Trump people, they're so indiscriminate that they bring cases that even a grand jury that is prepared to go along with almost anything says, look, this does not even meet the basic test of something we should indict. So, I'm encouraged.
Ben made a good point, which I'll just repeat here, which is he said that line is, you know, a prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich has actually misled a lot of people. And he said the reason that grand juries so rarely produce a so-called no bill, meaning refusing to indict, is because 99.9% of the time, the Justice Department would only bring good cases. They're only supposed to bring cases where they feel quite confident they can win at trial. Otherwise, they're not supposed to go to the grand jury. And so that filtering of weeding out the weak cases used to happen in any other Justice Department under any other president. So that's part of why we've lost sight of the fact that grand juries actually do perform a function. They're not just rubber stamps. So that's really cool. And so in addition, speaking of institutions that Will Salatin is going to stand for, because he is he's an institutionalist, he's a traditionalist.
A squish.
You're actually, Will, you're kind of a conservative at heart, even though you're a Democrat, you know?
I'll cop to that.
Yeah. You know, you believe in, if something has been going for centuries, don't break it unless you're sure that you've got something better to replace it. Is that fair?
That's an interesting question. We could go into this more, but we could also do it another time. I don't think I'm a conservative in that way, because I think there are a lot of things that have been going on forever that are terrible. But I'm a negativist. I like negating institutions. I think that part of the genius of the founding of America, we set up a system where if you think you know how everybody else should live and you have a plan to impose that on the country, we have a system that is designed to F you up. And that's, so I like all of those. I like all the checks and balances. It's why I like the filibuster. That's those are the institutions I like most, and including the grand jury.
Okay. Duly noted. And that is why I raised it at this moment, because next I want to talk about the filibuster. So Trump, like, cast your mind back to January and February, when it looked like, you know, anything, absolutely anything that Trump said he wanted, the Congress was going to do, you know, repeal the amendment about presidents only being able to serve two terms. They would have passed it. You know, if he had, no matter what he had asked for, they would have said yes. But in October and November, he was asking them to repeal the filibuster, just nuke the filibuster, because it was during the government shutdown. And they didn't. They said no. Which is interesting, right? I mean, it was a sign of resistance, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And this has been going, this, remember, for everybody who has forgotten, this was going on under Biden. This was, honestly, it's like it was a small faction of Democrats, Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin, like, no, we're not going to give up the filibuster. And you need those people to stand up in the moment. It happened under the Democrats. And somewhat to my surprise, so far, it's continued to happen under the Republicans. And it's the fear of what the majority on the other side might do. And I think that's a healthy instinct.
So I am not sure I agree with you about the filibuster. I think maybe it should be repealed. But I am rejoicing that this was a sign that the senators have some limits on what they will do, simply because the Orange God King asks them to. So that's good. Okay.
Can I make one concession to the anti-filibuster crowd?
Yeah.
The filibuster, sure. Like many other checks and balances, and again, the filibuster is not in the Constitution, so it's not at that level.
No.
But like other checks and balances in our system of one kind or another, it doesn't work if you don't use it. So if you have a sick culture, if the country becomes so sick that this is something that I think I'd have to go back and look at the Federalist Papers, but I don't think the founders quite appreciated that we would end up in a situation where members of Congress of the president's party would be so devoid of vertebrae that they would relinquish the powers. They would, instead of jealously guarding the powers of their branch, they would just turn over to the president of their party. If you won't exercise, you know, I think the argument that Jonathan Chait and others have made about the filibuster is that it has impeded Democrats from using power in situations where you have Trump has done all of his dirty work through executive power, and Congress has not acted. And we need Congress to be able to act against him. You can imagine a situation where that Democrats take the Senate at some point, and they're unable to act against an authoritarian president because of the filibuster. And, you know, there's some truth to that. But the filibuster will not cure the failure of politicians to stand up against other politicians who are taking away people's rights.
Absolutely. And 100%, the founders missed this one. They did think that the different branches would guard their power jealously, and they didn't foresee the strength of party loyalty would be stronger than institutional jealousy. That was a miss. Nobody's perfect, but the use of executive authority, though, I feel constrained to point out, did not start with Trump. The abuse of executive authority did not start with Trump, believe it or not. There have been many, many cases of it. I would say that George W. Bush putting signing statements in legislation that he was signing, basically vitiating what the legislation said and expecting the courts to clean it up, that was not good. Similarly, Barack Obama changing the Affordable Care Act on the fly through regulations when it was clearly stated in the legislation that he couldn't do what he was instructing his HHS secretary to do. Nope. He also did that with immigration. And even if I liked what he was doing, at the time I wrote that it was completely unacceptable for him to just make policy by diktat rather than asking Congress to change the law. And then, of course, Trump won. We don't think he ratchets it up to 11, but then Biden too. I mean, he tried through executive fiat to forgive, what was it, $400 billion of student loans?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and so there has been this tendency now for many years, many administrations, for presidents to sort of assert power that they should not have. And unfortunately, what happens all too often is if people like the outcome, you know, they'll say, I don't care how they did it, as long as they did it.
That's so true. Look, we are all guilty of this. I'll just speak for myself. I got, you know, when Trump came in and started doing all this executive stuff, I was like up in arms about it. And Steve Hayes pointed out to me, he said, you know, what Obama, hello, for all those years, Obama talking about, I've got a pen and a phone and I'm like,
Yeah.
I was exactly like this. I was like, hey, we're getting done what I want to get done. I'm not really paying attention to how. It takes an act of, I don't know if it's imagination, insight, something to think about what it would it be like if the power that you're enjoying exercising were in the hands of people you disagree with, right? And kind of, Mona, that's been what's been going on between some of the Republican senators and honestly, Mike Johnson and the Speaker of the House and Donald Trump. Trump's like, hey, let's get rid of the filibuster, right? Because we can do all this cool stuff. And those legislators, much as I dislike many of them or much as I despise them in some ways, on this issue, they have pointed out, think for a minute about what's going to happen because there's going to be Democrats in power again at some point and what they're going to do if we don't have a filibuster. So they're asking Donald Trump to undertake the act of imagination that you're talking about, which he is incapable of, right?
But that's because he couldn't care less. He could not care less about what après moi le déluge, as Louis XIV probably never said.
all royal quotes are apocryphal. Let's just get that out of the way.
He thinks in like 15-minute increments. You know, how do I get past this next thing? And right. He has no concern. And plus, that would require him to be concerned about the fate of his party or policy or anything else that's, you know, sort of down the road and divorced from him. He has no interest.
Right.
There's more. Tariffs. So after how many speeches and how much time and how much sturm and drang and complete mayhem created with the world economy and with American life has he created, all the while saying tariffs don't raise prices for Americans. They don't. They get paid by foreigners. They're good for the economy and they will stimulate, you know, domestic production, and they're great. And now he's repealing some of the tariffs on coffee and what else? Coffee and beef or no, not beef. What was it? Coffee and bananas or something, on the grounds that he wants to bring down the prices.
It feels so good when I beat your head against the wall less than I was doing a couple of months ago. This goes all the way back to, it was the weirdest thing to me. I mean, look, Donald Trump's always been in favor of tariffs, but you know, the Republican Party went along with him and all these people, Republicans who forever said taxes get passed along to the consumer, article of like Republican ideology.
Yeah,
we're just going to like somehow we're going to make a tariff exemption to this idea. Right. And there was this weird thing where like Mike Pence was like an outcast for basically standing where he had stood the whole time and saying, yeah, no, I'm not in favor of it because I don't like taxes. I don't think that we should be taxing, imposing more of a sales tax burden on Americans. And that's what Trump's doing. It's not just that it's a tax. It's that it's a regressive tax. When you're taxing food Everyone yes. needs food. Rich people don't need more. A rich person doesn't need more food than a poor person. It's like proportionally a much bigger part of the poor person's income. It's the exactly. worst thing to be taxing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. I mean, you know, all the things that so rich people, you know, are not going to feel it if they have to spend a little bit more on food. But a poor person, it's going to really bite, no pun intended. If you're like me, your skin needs a little extra care this time of year. Between colder weather and the rush of the holidays, it's easy for your skin to feel dry, dull, or stressed. That's why I've been sticking with OneSkin. You know how much I love their face cream, and it's been so great to have my daily routine continue to deliver the powerful skincare and longevity benefits that I cannot live without during this holiday season. At the core is their patented OS01 peptide, the first ingredient proven to target senescent cells, the root cause of wrinkles, crepiness, and loss of elasticity, all key signs of skin aging. And these results now have been validated in 5 different clinical studies. At the helm of this iconic skincare brand is their founding all-woman team of longevity scientists with PhDs in stem cell biology, skin regeneration, and tissue engineering. OneSkin also just launched their limited edition holiday sets, including the Nightly Rewind gift set, which adds the perfect touch of luxury to your gift list. It's the ultimate upgrade to any nightly ritual, featuring their best-selling face moisturizer, their brand new peptide lip mask, and a sculpting Gua Sha tool. Each element is designed to work together as your body enters its natural nightly repair mode, helping renew skin at the cellular level for a stronger, smoother, and more youthful-looking complexion. For a limited time, try OneSkin for 15% off using the code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Okay, so tariffs. By the way, my secret hope is that, and it won't happen because I think the Supreme Court is going to rule that his tariffs are illegal, but I wish they wouldn't because the tariffs are killing him. And his popularity on the economy is now at like 35% or something. So good, good. Actually, you know what? Here's the thing. We can have our cake and eat it too on this one, because what's going to happen is Supreme Court is going to rule that they're unconstitutional or that they're illegal, which is good because we want the Supreme Court to push back on him. And because his tariffs are utterly ridiculous. The rationale for them. What, we have an emergency that with Canada that requires us to place tariffs? You know, that's the rationale. Is that this is an emergency? It's so stupid that it would be good for our mental health to see the Supreme Court just, you know, blow that out of the water. But also, guess what? Even if they do that, he may not be off the hook in terms of his own self-sabotage, because there are a lot of other statutes out there that give him tariff power. So he can just change the rationale and probably get away with it the next time around and still have his tariffs, which means he'll still continue to dig the hole that he's in.
Okay. Now here's where I really am going to be the squish. I feel like, Mona, I want to talk you down from your vindictiveness, which I like share, you know, part
it's
of me
not,
shares it.
But it's not vindictive. It's not. It's for the good of the republic.
I want the best outcome. The best outcome is that these bad tariffs are overturned.
No. The best outcome is that he is discredited and MAGAism is discredited for a generation.
I would like to impose as little harm on the country and consumers as possible, and until we get to that point. And I would
okay,
like,
you are a squid. You know, so, no, I'm kidding.
I will say that I have been quite appalled at this goes on the subject of how authoritarian are we as a country? How susceptible are we to authoritarianism. I have been appalled at the extent to which other seemingly otherwise normal people in defense of Donald Trump's tariffs will make claims like we are in a national emergency. You know, this the emergency term has been used throughout history to invoke all kinds of evils. Yeah, set aside that rule, that norm. We're going to the Insurrection Act. Everything is an emergency. And the rhetoric coming. I mean, I saw Scott Bessent, a lifelong sort of Wall Street guy, like talking about we are in this global national emergency. Mona, it's a national security issue. We must have the tariffs. Why? Because the other countries tariff us. So our president needs to have unfettered authority, unfettered. Not, in other words, Congress, which is supposed to regulate this stuff, can have no say in it, so that this guy can defend all of us in a flash by imposing on his own tariffs. It is absolutely a straightforward strongman rationale. And you can go through the history of authoritarianism and atrocities, and you will see the invocation of emergency every time.
Absolutely right. Oh my God, where to begin? So what you say is so true. And also, I would point out that one of these so-called emergencies that they are relying upon, and they actually have written down so that people can point and laugh, is that we have been in an emergency because we are running trade deficits with a number of countries. Now, Will, if that's an emergency, it's been an emergency since 1975, which is when we first began to run these trade deficits. And of course, trade deficits are not an emergency. They're not even a problem. In fact, countries that run trade deficits seem to be, wealthier than those who run trade surpluses, because it's developing countries that are, eager to export their raw materials.
Right. Mona, what year, remind me, what year are we on the Jewish calendar? 57 something,
57 like, something? I don't know.
It's at least that many years that there have been trade deficits.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
So that's kind of absolutely absurd. The notion that this is an emergency. Plus, people recognize that the way these tariffs have been imposed frequently has nothing to do with trade deficits. We are imposing tariffs on Brazil, with whom we have a trade surplus, as it happens, because he doesn't like the fact that they are prosecuting his old buddy Jair Bolsonaro, or that the Canadians ran a commercial he didn't like. It's mind-boggling that we live in such a stupid time. But anyway, so the whole thing is risible. But he is like a terrier with a bone on this, and I don't know whether he loves tariffs because of all the unreviewable authority that it gives him, and he can just sort of use them as an all-purpose weapon. I tariff you, or whether he actually believes that this is somehow going to lead to a thriving economy. I don't know. But it is the Congress that has the authority. You can read it in the Constitution, which is right here, Declaration of Independence and Constitution of the United States. There's a section here. It's in Article 1 about the Congress shall have power to lay and collect tariffs and taxes. Here we go. No state shall, without the consent of the Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports, except that may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws, and so on. And there are other parts of the Constitution right. That make it crystal clear that it is Congress that has this authority, not the president. And if the Congress, they can give some of their authority to the president through law, but they have to explicitly say so. And they did not do that in this particular law that he's relying on. Anyway, I do think that he was reelected on the basis of two things. He thinks this. He has said it, that it was the border and groceries, as he put it. It was prices. And people believed that he was some kind of magician, that, you know, great businessman. They saw him on The Apprentice. We had a good economy until COVID hit. And that if they voted him back in, they would be able to get back the economy of 2019. He told them that on day one, he was going to reduce prices. And they believed him. And of course, not only Trump, nobody knows how to bring down prices. You can't bring down prices. All you can do is try to get wages up. But he's done something worse than that. Not only is he not focusing on getting wages up or, you know, stimulate, he is doing the one thing that is guaranteed to raise prices, not just allow them to come back down. And so it's good for the sake of the country that he be seen for what he is, which is an imposter, a fraud, a liar of the first order who has no idea what he's doing, but for his own twisted reasons is trying to torpedo the economy.
Yeah. On the subject of the cost of groceries and costs going up, Trump, especially when you see what the actual election results were, he could have gotten elected making a simpler statement, which is, I will get control of inflation. Because inflation makes prices go up. Not promising to bring prices down, because as you point out, you're not going to come out of the crazy inflation we had, it's been coming down the whole time. It was coming down under Biden, but it was high, and you're not going to get prices down from that. As you said, Mona, you're going to try to slow the growth of prices. If you're really lucky, stop it and then get wages to catch up with it. But he promised to bring prices down and continues to say that he will bring prices down, a thing that no sound economic advisor would tell him to say, right? It's almost like he doesn't care at all about the truth value of his statements and thinks that he is, he thinks he's impervious to falsification. Like, I can just tell he has lied about absolutely everything. And he thinks that this principle will extend to telling people that their grocery prices are going down. I'm taking the other side of that bet. And I think if you look at those election results from early November, you see the evidence that that doesn't work, because at some point people may not care that you lied about January 6th or that you got, one of the things, if you look at exit polls from 2024, Donald Trump won in part because people who knew that he was lying about the 2020 election, when he continues to say he won it, they're just like, that's his lie, right? That's not important. What's important is what you said. He's going to bring us back the economy of 2018, 2019, right? And that's what my life is about. I need, some kitchen table stuff. And it turns out that someone who lies about that stuff will also lie to you about your own life. And he thinks he's going to get away with it. But the evidence from the election results this year is no. They're not buying it. Right. I know that my grocery prices they're still going up. You know that. Everybody out there knows it. And here's this president trying to tell us. And his people, Scott Bessent and Kevin Hassett and the other economic advisors, they go on TV and they literally say, Mona, they're saying right now, we're not going to do what Joe Biden did. We're not going to try to snow you about what's going on in your life. That's literally what they say. We're not going to pretend that everything's cool when you know it isn't. Meanwhile, the actual principal, the president of the United States, is saying exactly that all the time. Exactly. Grocery prices are going down. Everything's great. Nobody's buying it.
And I forgot to say one other thing that you reminded me. Not only is he imposing these tariffs, which are making the prices go up, but he is deporting so many people who provide labor that keeps prices down. So all these agricultural workers and others who are getting deported or who are afraid to show up for work because they're afraid of getting deported, guess what? That also makes your prices of your food go up. So on both ends, he is really screwing the American consumer.
Yeah. And people don't, for folks out there who think that these are separable issues, I want to just explain that they go together. A lot of people think, okay, the tariffs are like imposing a barrier to goods, that they're raising the price of the goods coming in. That's getting, they understand that part. This gets passed along to me. My prices are going up. The immigration stuff is similar to that. And people think, oh, you know, we're just enforcing immigration laws. You're messing with the supply of labor. The tariffs are about the supply of goods. Immigration is about the supply of labor. And it's exactly what you said, Mona. You're driving inflation on the side of the of labor, which, as Hassett and Besson and others will tell you, like the labor stuff is driving a lot of the cost increases now.
Great. I'm so glad we have geniuses in charge. Okay. Okay. Two more items on our happy list. A series of senators made a video saying because they had been receiving calls and inquiries from their districts, from people who are serving members of the military who are distressed. And they're saying, what do I do if I get an illegal order? What should I do? And so members of the Senate who served in the military did a series of videos saying, you do not have to obey an illegal order. In fact, you are obligated not to obey an illegal order. Now, admittedly, this gets a little dicey for the members of the services, because the fact is, Trump has also fired a good number of the JAG officers, who are the people who actually tell the officers whether an order is legal or illegal. I mean, they don't necessarily know. And so if you don't have a JAG officer telling you this is legal, this isn't, then you're really risking like insubordination and possible court martial. So it's really tough. It's a very tough position for members of the military to be in. But the important thing is that the senators made these videos and risked and incurred the wrath of Trump.
So Mona, remind me, is it Shakespeare about the first thing we do about the kill, get rid of the lawyers? What's the line? I can't remember.
First we kill
what it
all
is.
The lawyers. Yeah.
First we kill all the lawyers. Right. In this case, the military lawyers, because they like the kind of lawyers who will defend their whatever Donald Trump does. It's the kind of lawyers who actually give ethical advice or like what the rules are. They hate those kinds of lawyers.
Right.
This whole episode, I want to pause on this. So there's some senators, some members of the House of Representatives. I think there's like half a dozen of them who made this video. I would encourage everyone to watch it. It's a minute and a half. Just go, you can look it up online. It says refuse illegal orders. That is the line, refuse illegal orders. And that's what those lawmakers say over and over again. The word is illegal. And this somehow provoked a backlash from the administration, claiming that this meant that they were supposed to reject Donald Trump's orders. Well, that's the administration essentially confessing that if you say refuse illegal orders, you're talking about Donald Trump's orders. Like, there is no problem with refusing illegal orders if you believe that the president's orders are all legal. In fact, after this happened early last week, the Pentagon announced an investigation of Senator Mark Kelly, who was one of the senators who spoke in the video. And the statement from the Pentagon announcing this investigation of Kelly for what he said in the video, he said the statement was that all service members are reminded that they have a legal obligation under the UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, to obey lawful orders. And orders that are presumed to be lawful, a service member's personal philosophy does not justify or excuse the disobedience of an otherwise lawful order. So you're hearing over and over again the word lawful and legal. Yes, you have a legal obligation to obey the law. That's a tautology. All of this stuff is tautological. The question is, do you believe that Donald Trump's orders are lawful? And apparently the White House doesn't, based on their overreaction to this.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right. And I think you're right. I mean, this is a confession on their part. Those orders to summarily execute people in boats on the high seas, obviously illegal. I can imagine it's causing a lot of, you know, guilty consciences and a lot of distress on the part of the members of the military who are carrying it out. I guess it's the Navy. I don't think it's the Navy. But it's a disgusting abuse of power. It makes the United States into an aggressor. It makes us into the bully and the murderer. Not the country that others used to turn to as an example of, you know, the rules-based international order that we were the key nation in creating and propping up since World War II.
Yeah. I want to call attention to something that most people might overlook that Donald Trump has been saying about this. He routinely now brags when he's doing these Oval Office events that since they've been firing missiles and killing blowing up these boats, he says there's no fishing boats out in the water anymore. He says nobody goes out anymore. Even the he said I don't even see any fishing boats. The fishermen like that, and he thinks this is really funny.
He thinks it's and funny.
He's explicitly talking about civilians there. He's explicitly talking about people who are like just trying to make a living. They're not delivering drugs to Florida. They're just like fishing, and they're afraid to go out because they're afraid the Americans are going to blow them up. Now, a normal civilized human being who happened to be president of the United States would want to tell the world, hey, you know what? We're not after you. We're trying to do this very judiciously. And here's the procedures we go through. And you should feel free to go about your business. That is not Donald Trump. To him, it's a boast that he is scaring the civilians.
This show is sponsored by GhostBed. In a world where everything seems overpriced these days, it's refreshing to find a company that delivers real quality at a fair price. That's what GhostBed is all about. This family-run company was created and is still managed by mattress manufacturing experts with more than 20 years of hands-on experience. They know how to build a bed that's durable, supportive, and comfortable without the inflated markups you see from so many other brands. GhostBed keeps their prices up to 50% lower than comparable brands by doing things like partnering with multiple U.S.-based factories, streamlining their product line, and investing in premium materials instead of flashy ads. The result is exceptional comfort and cooling performance at a price that makes sense. Every GhostBed mattress includes advanced cooling technology to help regulate your temperature through the night, and their exclusive ProCore layer provides targeted support through your hips and back, promoting proper alignment and pressure relief. Each mattress is backed by a 20 to 25 year warranty and comes with a 101 night sleep trial, so you can make sure that it's the right fit for you. Shipping is fast and free. Most orders arrive in 2 to 5 days. So if the news is keeping you up at night, give them a try. Right now, during GhostBed's Cyber Monday sale, you can get 25% off site-wide for a limited time. Just go to ghostbed.com/Mona and use promo code Mona at checkout. That's ghostbed.com/Mona, promo code Mona. Upgrade your sleep with GhostBed, the makers of the coolest beds in the world. Some exclusions apply. See site for details.
One other thing. In this video, the lawmakers say explicitly, this administration is pitting our uniformed military and intelligence community professionals against American citizens. So they're not even talking in the video about the Venezuelan boat strikes. They're talking about the use of they're concerned about the use of the military against Americans. For the White House to react in outrage about this is to basically confess that they've got in mind the use of the military domestically, that this is not Absolutely. Even about some foreign conflict.
Yeah.
That's quite alarming to me that they're trying to like suggest that the military should not worry about whether they're acting lawfully when they are acting against American citizens. So they're already crossing that threshold. I think that's another vindication of these lawmakers that they're putting out this message because they see what's coming.
There is no limiting principle, right? I mean, it's like I declare that these are narco-terrorists without any evidence. They have presented no evidence. They gave a few briefings to only Republicans on the Hill, not the Democrats, which is, again, a complete departure from the way things are always done. There has been no request for a declaration of war, which you kind of need, or at least an authorization of military force, such as George H.W. Bush got before going into Kuwait, and as George W. Bush got after 9/11. The authorization of military force covered a lot. Arguably, maybe it was pressed too far in certain instances, and those were controversial, especially with Obama using a lot of drones, including against, in one case, an American citizen. But at least there was an authorization for military force. I mean, it wasn't simply that the president decides, I want to kill some people, and I am going to instruct our military to do so. And, you know, this idea of just declaring somebody to be a narco-terrorist gives you some sort of, it's a nullity. That means nothing legally. That doesn't establish anything. And we're not at war. This is a police activity. You know, it's, anyway. It's all unbelievably disgusting and un-American at the deepest level. And I am very glad to see finally that members of the legislature are standing up to oppose it. Obviously, it would be a lot better if all of the Congress, including Republicans, did so. There was not a single Republican on those videos, I assume.
None of them were Republicans in that group.
So, you know, that's kind of. It's awful. But it was done, and that's good. And then I guess finally, I think we should close on this. So we just discussed one of the worst things this administration is doing, which is outright extrajudicial murder on the high seas. Some of these people may not even be drug runners. And even if they were, even if they were running drugs, okay, it's not a capital offense, okay? It's not like they were pointing their guns at anybody. It's not like they were shooting at Americans. They are committing a crime that can get you many years behind bars after a fair trial, but it is not a capital offense. You don't get executed for it, far less executed without a trial, without any evidence, and just summarily. Anyway, sorry. So that's one of the worst things this administration is doing. But another is using the power of the federal government, using its awesome prosecutorial authority to target political enemies of the president. So, but as we are recording this, we now have word that one of the judges in the case against James Comey and Letitia James has just ruled that Lindsey Halligan was unlawfully appointed, and therefore the cases are dismissed, which is another blow to this clown show of an administration.
I'm pretty sure about this one, that Jack Smith got The Trump got off on the classified documents case, not because he was ever vindicated on the merits. He wasn't. He was absolutely guilty based on the evidence. But Judge Cannon fell for the argument that Jack Smith was illegitimately appointed, and that on this technicality she chucked the case, and that's part of why we ended up with Trump as president. So it's just poetically perfect here that we've had turnabout in the case of Lindsey Halligan. But Mona, I've got to confess that this is the one topic where I'm probably more vindictive than you. Maybe you can disabuse me of this. Look, Jim Comey is innocent. I hope he has to spend as little time as possible dealing with these garbage allegations and charges. But I really, really would like, instead of just getting rid of these cases, I suspect that the prosecutorial wrongdoing that went into the prosecutions of the charges against Comey, against Letitia James, who was the third one? There's various other people. The Bolton case might be different.
Adam Schiff. They're going.
Adam Schiff is another one. They're trying to do Adam Schiff. I think that if you go behind the scenes And there's some signs that, you know, the judge asked for like some of the materials. What did you present to the grand jury? Like, I think this grand jury was misled. I think Lindsay Halligan engaged in prosecutorial misconduct. Again, these are my suspicions. I don't have full evidence for them yet. Certainly, Donald Trump literally ordered Pam Bondi to take action against these people. I would really love for there to be, and this sounds ridiculous, but I'm going to say it, an investigation of the investigation of the investigation. Like, I just think this is one of the dirtiest things. And if we can get the evidence, it will be tremendous. And I'm sort of just regretful, Mona, that, you know, if this all goes away based on the technicality of she was illegally appointed, Lindsay Halligan was illegally appointed, that we're not going to get my fantasy of the investigation of the investigation of the investigation. But I will accept that.
So I just have to say there are these two challenges to this indictment from Comey that were going on separate tracks and being heard by separate judges. So one was about whether Halligan was illegally appointed or inappropriate, unlawfully appointed. And that's the one we got the decision about. The one that I was following, and I even read the transcript because I did a podcast about this last week. I even read the transcript of the hearing with the judge last Wednesday about exactly what you were just saying about how, what did she present to the grand jury and so on. There might not have even been an indictment. I mean, she was so clueless about criminal law and about, she had never worked a day in her life in criminal law. She had never been a prosecutor. She was an insurance lawyer. And so she didn't know the basics. And also she misrepresented things to the grand jury. This part is just gobsmacking, that she would tell, you don't even have to be a lawyer, far less a criminal lawyer or a prosecutor, to know this much. She told the grand jury that that Comey would have to testify at trial, and that they, you know, which of course everybody knows, you don't have to testify against yourself in a trial. That's in the Fifth Amendment. And the other thing she told them, and this was really, I mean, that was bad enough, but this is this one. So we were talking earlier, I guess this comes full circle now. We were talking before about how important it is that there's a grand jury, because when the government wants to come after you and destroy your life, they have to see the evidence and make a determination as to whether there's really a case. She told this grand jury, according to the magistrate judge's report, that they didn't have to make their decision to indict or not indict based only on what she was telling them in this grand jury. They could assume that they had more and better evidence that was going to be coming out at trial. So the judge is like, yeah, we don't do things like that.
Mona, can I ask, this is just a conspiracy theory. Famously, Halligan had to do this herself. Nobody in the office would do it, right? And she had to put her name on the papers and all this stuff. Do you think that they knew she was going to step on the rake and they let her go in there? Like, any basic advice, anyone who gave her legal advice who knew what they were doing could have told her stuff like this, right? And they just let her go in. And
so I like the way your mind is working, but I would just say, actually, I don't know whether that there was time, because she gets appointed and the clock is ticking because of the statute of limitations. And so she basically rushes into court like 2 or 3 days after her appointment. When mm-hmm. And during those 2 or 3 days, rather than getting advice about how to bring this case, she was probably figuring out where the ladies' room was and, you know, whatever, like signing all of her, getting her building pass and whatnot. I don't know that she will have had time to get advice about how to bring a case.
Right. Most conspiracy theories, it requires too much, right? Like simpler. The reason why conspiracy theories are false is there's incompetence explains most things, as in this case, right? And also
this is truly, I mean, you know, Ben Wittes said about the first Trump administration that it was malevolence leavened by incompetence. And this time we saw much more malevolence and not quite as leavened by incompetence, because with people like Russ Vogt and others who actually are doing real damage. And even though I wouldn't call Doge competent, they certainly did accomplish a lot of terrible damage to people, especially poor people around the world. But the incompetence is racing forward now. Right. It's been supercharged. And Lindsay Halligan is like the hood ornament now for the incompetence of Trump 2.0.
Yeah. Yeah. The incompetence, I agree with, and Ben may have made this point, I agree that the malevolence is several notches up from the first Trump administration, but so is the incompetence. Maybe it's taken a little bit longer for it to catch up with them. Yeah. The malevolence has been so, like, they did so much damage quickly.
Yes.
Because they did learn from the first, they did learn,
yes,
let's act fast.
Yes.
And so,
yes,
we saw that up front, and now we're starting to see the incompetence catch up a little bit more.
Right. And that is a great thing. And I'm happy to close this out on that happy note.
Right.
Will, thank you so much for doing this with me. It was really fun.
Thank you, Mona. I'm very thankful for you.
Likewise. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy holidays.